The True Tone Lounge podcast features audio-only versions of our video interviews. To view those, please visit TrueToneLounge.com or our YouTube channel, youtube.com/TrueToneFX.
So it was a hard decision to go with Elton and you had all these opportunities that were and things that were going on before, and then all of a sudden you're going to say no to him because but you're going to be on this huge stage playing with a major artist.
Yeah. The thing that kind of tipped the scales for me with Elton to do it was that his album Made in England was such a great album.
Okay.
I really loved the music on that album. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, I had a meeting with him in his hotel suite in Beverly Hills. And I said, God, I don't know. I've got all this stuff going on. And he said, well, it sounds like maybe you're too busy for this gig, but let me play you my new album.
Okay.
Smart thing to do. He had a killer stereo. He put it on. The first track was called Believe. Great classic British pop with great string arrangements. Paul Buckmaster, you know, Beatly sounding British, like everything I like. Mm-hmm. You know, great Elton John melodies. So I thought, yeah, this is good, but it's probably the only good song on the album. Well, the next song was called Made in England. It starts with kind of a Hard Day's Night chord.
Yeah.
And then this high energy riffy guitar stuff and very melodic. Again, like every song was just great. I was like, really?
Yeah.
If I'm going to get to play this with this artist,
mm-hmm.
then, you know, if I can't play music that I love, why am I in the music business?
Yeah.
So that kind of flipped it for me.
So that was the, you know, I guess, you know, one of the biggest stages you ever had, you know, kind of the opportunity to play on, playing. So what are some things that you learned from Elton, working with, an artist of that, you know, stature and playing on that big of a stage?
Well, that's a really good question. I learned so much. First, one of the things that sticks out is that it was a fair-sized band, and I was the second guitarist. So I had kind of been letting my multi-instrumental part of my being kind of, I hadn't been pushing that. Because at one point I realized that in order to be taken seriously as a guitarist, you couldn't be thought of as a multi-instrumentalist. So I felt like I had to make my footprint as a guitarist.
Mm-hmm.
And then, okay, let that other stuff go. But with Elton, he already had Davy Johnston, you know, and he did need second guitar in a lot of things. But then there was many songs that didn't need it. But they needed pedal steel, which I could play. They needed mandolin. They needed saxophone. So, and needed harmony vocals, percussion, whatever. So I played a lot of all those different instruments. You know, a tiny dancer, I'd play pedal steel.
Yeah.
So, you know, it kind of reignited my multi-instrumental abilities. And then the other thing was, you know, performance-wise, I was one of the few people that was mobile. Elton wasn't mobile. The keyboard player, Guy Babylon, wasn't mobile. Drummer's not mobile. Percussionist is not mobile. So that only left me, Davey, and Bob Birch. And Bobber's bass player.
Right.
So he just, and he wasn't that kind of mobile. He just wasn't that guy. He was like, stay there and just, you know, anchor everything.
Yeah.
So is Davey and I were the ones. So I could totally rock with him. You know, we had a great relationship. And he was also one of the main reasons why I decided to take the gig, because I really liked him and I liked his playing. And I knew that we would have fun around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so the other thing was like, okay, musically, what I can add to this show is limited sounds demeaning, but there was only so much space. And it's a piano player's gig.
Yeah.
So you got his piano, which is big, and his voice, which is big. Everything else needs to find their spot. Okay. So my musical contributions could be only slotted in certain ways. So in order to challenge myself, I decided, what can I do? I can try to connect and perform more. Not taking anything away from Elton or getting in his spotlight, but say there's these people way up there in the balcony. How can I make them feel part of this show and connect with all these people? So it was a challenge personally to expand myself as a performer and connect with bigger audiences and bigger places than I ever had.
Right.
You know, 15, 17, 20,000 people. That's not easy to connect with those people. But then I kind of got used to it, you know, and I think I kept challenging myself. And then we went to some stadiums, you know, which were like massive, like football stadiums and things. Well, they didn't have a roof, you know, so the energy wasn't contained. The energy just dissipated. So that was even harder to put out enough energy to bring people in. And then when we went back to back to arenas, I thought, oh, okay, this is sort of intimate now, yeah. You know, like Madison Square Garden felt intimate.
And
I realized that I had accrued more performing power, if you might want to describe it like that. And I really felt like I could connect with that. So that was one thing I learned. And I also learned how hard it is to be consistently great on every single part that you need to do. And how nice it is to have consistency in your monitors, in your staging, and all of that, you know. And also how much pressure there would be on a person like Elton, where 24/7 people want something, you know. And that's, yeah, okay, it comes with fame and whatever, but, you know, kind of give the guy a break at some point.
Yeah.
And I also saw it how at some point it becomes, I guess maybe they felt like they'd written everything they could about his music. So they would rarely write about the music. You know, it would be about what he wore or what he said or about his weight or some other bullshit thing. It was like, seriously? You have a world-class artist here with a huge canon of songs, you know.
And all you can talk about are superfluous things.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like seriously. But during that time, 1997, of course, August 31st, Princess Diana got killed.
Mm-hmm.
And she was, it wasn't just a celebrity friendship, they were really friends.
Okay.
So when he sang at her funeral, that was one of my most proud moments, you know, to know him. Because that had to be really hard, you know. It was a song he'd done a million times with new words, mm-hmm. you know, in this cathedral. For his friend,
yeah,
you know, who's just not only died, but she was a princess, you know.
Yeah.
And after that, our concerts after that, the intensity level rose. And so we'd be doing a song like "Don't Let the Sun Go Down on Me" or something like that, and the feeling from the audience was so big that I asked Davey. I said, back in the 70s, you know, at the height of everything, was it more intense than this? I can't imagine it more intense.
Yeah.
And he thought for a minute, he said, no, it was like this, you know.
Yeah.
This was, he said, the only time it was more was when John Lennon came on stage at Madison Square Garden.
Oh, my God.
And then it was just like,
yeah.
You know, like nothing else, pandemonium for 15 minutes, people wouldn't stop applauding.
Yeah, I think he only did like two songs or, yeah.
Yeah.
Whatever helps you make through the night.
Yeah, whatever gets you through the night. And I saw her standing there.
Yeah.
You know, and that was off a bet.
Yeah.
You know, he said, oh, yeah, I'll come and play it on stage if it goes number one.
Yeah.
Not thinking it would.
Wow.
But I felt so lucky to be with an artist of that stature at a time when their career was at a very high place.
Right.
Which doesn't usually happen with someone who's been around as long as he has.
Because he kind of had a resurgence with the Disney films that he had worked
with. Lion King.
And then, of course, his albums, he had a whole nother level of resurgence.
Yeah. And you know, he's such an unusually great artist. Through him, I got to work with Chris Thomas as a producer, who worked with the Beatles mm-hmm. and Pink Floyd and David Bowie and Pete Townsend and In Excess and Pretenders and on and on and on. That was a big treat.
Absolutely.
We're doing Elton's album, The Big Picture, and I think Blur was in the next studio, and The Pretenders were recording in there too, so I get to hang out with Chrissy Hynde, who's a big fan. Through him, I got to play with George Michael, Sting, Pavarotti, Billy Joel, Kiki D, Bryan Adams, Mary J. Blige, you know, on and on. All of these artists who I probably wouldn't have got a chance to play with otherwise.
Yeah.
Phil Collins, Natalie Cole. Anyway, on and on. Yeah.
On and on and on. So then the Django, the spirit of Django, you know, kind of comes upon you. You kind of transition from Elton to playing, and you end up even playing Django in a movie, and they make you up to look like Django, and they do up your hand.
That was so fun. That's another, you know, back to something we'd spoken about earlier, is timing and luck and things like that. Mm-hmm. Well, back when I first discovered Django and first started playing that music in 1979-80, had there been any kind of scene at all, that's where I would have gone. Mm-hmm. But I realized there wasn't. There was nothing. You know, no one was interested. There was no festivals. There was no place to play. So I realized that music just had to be my hobby music. And I'd have a career doing something else. Well, so years later, the internet is there. There's two different things happened. The internet came along, and I think people with fringe interests were able to find each other. And there was enough people interested in Django that found each other to start having a festival in America. You know, there was festivals in France. I'd been there. I was one of the few Americans to go over there. And I was still learning about the music, still loved it, and I'd play it on my own. In fact, my first album as a solo artist was that style of music.
Yeah,
after you've gone.
Yes.
And I'd done that just at the beginning of Desert Rose Band because I thought that I would never play that music again. And I wanted a record of that. Mm-hmm. But I'd remained interested and still played it from time to time and, you know, went to festivals, as I said. But the other thing that happened around the turn of the century was that some guitar manufacturers were starting to reissue guitars like Django played, mm-hmm. which were a Selmer guitar designed by Mario McAferry. Very specific guitar. And these guitars were so rare, you know, that anyone learning that music, it's the chances of finding one. I was lucky, and I found an original one. And my band, back in the Disneyland days, we had three original Selmers in our band.
Wow.
Just unheard. Mm-hmm. But it happened. But there wasn't copies. Those are all we could find. Now there was affordable copies that were really well made. And there was all these people could get interested. So we started having festivals here in America. Now, timing and preparation, I was already a bit more known than other people that were playing that style. And I had a number of years on them of playing the style. So during that time, I was approached by a guy who was music producing for a film called Head in the Clouds. He asked me if I could recreate a couple of Django's tracks, which that was like, yes, please. That would be so fun. Yeah. And then I ended up getting to play Django on camera as well. So at that time, I was actually working on a follow-up album to After You've Gone, which is almost 20 years before. Mm-hmm. And that gave me a lot more impetus. You know, if I don't use this opportunity to finish this album and get some promotion.
Right.
So that's what I did. And I came out with an album called Franco-American Swing, which, to my mind, that music is very much a combination of French and American, because Django and Stefan, of course, were French. But the music they were playing was written all by Americans for the most part, unless Django composed it himself. But they were inspired by Louis Armstrong and Duke Ellington and Cab Calloway and Fats Waller. And Dino was the first thing they recorded together. So everything, you know, it was informed by an American, but it was done with a French perspective. So here you have this great international collaboration.
Yeah.
And that album did really well for me. It was featured on a lot of magazines, and it kind of got me playing all the festivals around America and Europe. And in fact, I got to headline the Django Reinhardt Memorial Festival in France. I'm the only American ever to headline that festival playing gypsy jazz, which was very intimidating, but one of my career highlights for sure.
Yeah. So you've continued to play the Django music, but then you have these other outlets.
And
as an outsider, you know, just from seeing, I feel like you desire, you know, diverse musical stimulation. Like you seem to need that.
Yeah, and that's absolutely right. And I guess it's just the way that I grew up. Yeah. You know, because I was always in a symphony band or an orchestra, but I was also in a rock band.
Yeah.
You know, and then as I was older, I was in ensembles, woodwind quintet or a saxophone quartet or something like that, but also in a rock band or jazz band and then at Disneyland, multiple bands in a day. So that's just, it's just part of my being. And, you know, one thing I got to do when I moved to Nashville in 2000, I lived in California pretty much my whole life. And then in Nashville from 2000 to 2012, I lived in Nashville. And during that time, my friend Brad Davis, who had been playing guitar with Marty Stewart, I think at the time, he recommended me to the Scruggs family to play with Earl.
Right.
Wow. Fantastic. Yeah. You know, I mean, here and I'm playing with the king of bluegrass.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, sorry, Jimmy Martin. I know you're the king of bluegrass, but
yeah.
Earl is the king of the banjo. And and so I got to play. They wanted me to play electric guitar, but I snuck the mandolin in there too.
Yeah.
And so that was a really big treat to play with him. Yeah. And, you know, John Randall was one of the other musicians. Gary Scruggs, his son. Randy Scruggs, sometimes also his son. Either Rob Ikes or Jennifer Kennedy on dobro. And Glenn Duncan on fiddle or Hoot Hester at times as well. So it's a great bunch of people, slightly revolving cast. But then when Earl passed away, I really missed playing bluegrass. So I decided I had to put together a bluegrass band.
Your own band. So there's the John Jorgensen Bluegrass Band.
Yeah. And I loved like jamming backstage with John Randall, so I asked him to come and play guitar and sing.
Right.
I had met Mark Fain, and I had heard at the time that he had just left Ricky Skaggs' band, so I asked him. And Herb, you know, never got a chance to play banjo that much nowadays. You know, he replaced Doug Dillard in the Dillards, and he even subbed for Earl Scruggs in Flattened Scruggs. And he's a great banjo player and a great singer. So I asked him to come and play banjo. And, you know, that I didn't realize what a great vocal blend that the three of us would have, but it was pretty magical. And then as we got going, we did an album. John Randall is friends with Sheryl Crow. She let us use her studio. So we did a nice album at her place. It's called From the Crow's Nest. And then when we started going out to perform, John had had twins by that time and had a pretty busy family life and career life. So was really not that available to go out and play with us. So we brought in a guitarist from California who had grown up. His father was best friends with Bill Bryson.
Okay.
His name is Tom Sauber's his father. His name is Patrick Sauber. And Patrick is an excellent guitar, mandolin, banjo player. And he plays also with Grisman and Peter Rowan and Laurie Lewis. And so he's kind of part of our family as well. So he came in as guitarist and singer. And we also have a great trio vocal sound. So that's the current lineup of J2B2, which is short for John Jorgensen Bluegrass Band. So 2 years ago now, I had a release of a box set called De Virtuoso. And it's a word that I made up to say playing various different styles at a high level. Sometimes people will play a lot of styles, but they might not be at a high level in each of them.
Right.
And my standards are really, really high. So I thought that would be a good way to describe what was in the album. And it's three different CDs. One is Gypsy Jazz with my quintet. Mm-hmm. One is J2B2 with my bluegrass band. And the third is called Gifts from the Flood, which is an electric guitar album.
Right.
And it features many of my guitars and amps and effects that were in the Nashville flood of 2010. Oh. And when they were fixed and repaired and came back to me, they each gave me songs. And I put together those to showcase my electric guitar playing. Yeah. And I ended up playing a lot of keyboards and bass and other things on that album. But so those are my three different ensembles. Yeah. The bluegrass album from that is going to be released separately.
Okay.
Coming up at the end of this year. So that's really nice because I think it got kind of ignored overall because the bluegrass world, they actually, it's a negative if you play other styles of music. So we want to get that out there to let people hear it. And then, so I've got those three bands. I also produce. I just produced an album from a live show called Tribute to John D. Loudermilk, where 26 different artists came and performed one song each of John D. Loudermilk's at the Franklin Theater here in Tennessee. My wife put the show together, produced it. I was the musical director, played mandolin, acoustic guitar, electric guitar, piano, organ, sang as a lead vocalist and as a harmony vocalist, and as a music directed everything. So we had Ricky Skaggs and the Whites, Tommy Emmanuel, Roseanne Cash, Emmylou Harris, Rodney Crowell, Buddy Green, John McPhee, and John Cowan, both from the Doobie Brothers, Becky Hobbs, Bobby Braddock, Nora Wilson, his last performance, Claudia Church, Beth Hooker, Beth Nielsen Chapman, Doyle Lawson and Quicksilver.
no lack of talent.
Leroy Parnell, Billy Burnett, probably forgetting Herb Peterson. Unbelievable amount of talent to be on one stage at one time. And now it's turned into an album. 24 of the tracks could fit on an album.
Okay.
And I mixed and edited all that. And it's in consideration for a Grammy nomination. So fingers crossed. That's something that I kind of look at is taking a whole bunch of my different skill sets all at once. It's pushed me. Yeah.
All on one project.
Yeah. Mixing and editing and all of the technical part of it and performing and band leading and blah, 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 all these different things.
Yeah.
Wow. It's a lot. That's out now. And I've been touring with Chris Hillman and Herb Peterson and Mark Fain on some of the shows.
Okay.
An acoustic lineup that's promoting Chris's recent album that was produced by Tom Petty, who we sadly lost recently, and it's been a really nice way to kind of regroup with that trio. And again, vocally, that trio has a particular magic to it that I don't know if people think about it that much, but I've been noticing it at shows and at the comments. You know, people say, wow, it is amazing when Chris and Herb sing together, but then when all three of you sing together, it's this whole other thing, you know? So that's been nice to revisit. And we're just about to the end of that tour. We might continue doing some shows together next year. And then I've got a Christmas album coming out with a group from Quebec called The Lost Fingers.
Okay.
And their name refers to the fingers that Django Reinhardt was not able to use on his left hand. And they started their life as a band that would take pop songs and do them in a gypsy jazz style.
Okay.
And it has since it's progressed from that. That was a little bit of a novelty or kitsch element, I'd say. But now it's more, it's very, very creative. So they have guests like Burley LeGrand and Cyril Aimé, and they have Iranian musicians and Indian musicians and musicians from the Canary Islands and all of these. I get to play, I think I haven't played bassoon yet, but I play every keyboard you can imagine, every type of guitar from flamenco to heavy metal, to bluegrass, mandolin, to percussion, to creating choirs and background vocals. They're a very talented group, and they just let me go as far as I want to go. There's rapping in there. There's Beastie Boys parts. There's choirs. There's, yeah, all kind of things.
Again, the diversity, the, you know, the eclectic nature of it, you know, it seems like you're drawn to that kind of thing.
It totally, just, totally yeah. appeals to me.
Yeah. So just to revisit this a touch, only because I had listened to, of course, after, you know, Tom Petty passed away, they were playing a lot of his, you know, more recent interviews. And in one of the interviews, he'd been asked about working on the Hillman record. And Tom said some very nice things about your playing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it kind of broke my heart, to be honest with you.
Yeah. To hear someone that was that influential say nice things.
Yeah. Yeah. And I, you know, I loved his music too. And like I said earlier, I was very close to Howie Epstein. I'd done different playing with Ben Montench over the years and with Steve Ferroni and with Stan Lynch.
Yeah.
And Tom and I, well, we connected on the Beatles for sure.
Yeah.
You know, he found out that I was a massive Beatles fan, and I went over to do a guitar part, and he brought out that book that, you know, the one that's really limited edition that shows the mic placements and all that kind of stuff, and we're just geeking out incredibly over this stuff to the point where Herb, as the co-producer, was like, come on, you guys.
Yeah.
And I really felt like that there was going to be a lot of times where we would get to hang and talk about that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
You know, and also very close family friends of mine, the Webb sisters, who that's yet another project. But the Webb sisters sang with Leonard Cohen on his last batch of touring seasons and with Tom Petty on his last tour. And they're close family friends. And we've done some stuff together. We've done a tour over in Europe and we're talking about doing another tour.
Yeah.
Because we really love singing together too, and they're brilliant musicians. They play harp and guitar and mandolin, and so it's a cool combination. But anyway, you know, there's a lot of personal connection with him, and then you know, to hear that on that interview was like made me really proud and but kind of heartbroken at the same time.
Yeah. So, you know. What kind of, you know, when Tom was, you know, producing a track, what kind of input would he give you?
He was so sly, you know. He knew that as soon as we heard whatever worked or whatever didn't work, that we would go in that direction. So he was very much like, you guys need to come in and listen to this. Not in listen to how good it is or it sucks. Just come in, you know, just come in and listen. And he would know, you know, whether something is going to work or not, you know, and didn't, and he would also be really ready. Like if someone to say, oh, maybe we should have John put a mandolin on this, boom, he wants to do it right now.
Yeah.
You know, or say, oh, maybe we should double this acoustic 12 string with an electric 12 string. I'm like, well, I'm not planning for that. He says, oh, we'll get one of Mike's and get, what amp do you want?
Yeah.
Boom, AC30, like, boom. It's there. You do the part.
Yeah.
So I could tell that he knows, don't let the energy or the moment go. Just get it. Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter if it's perfect. Boom. Get that.
Yeah.
And another thing that happened was that Chris and Herb, they're forever singing some kind of duet thing all the time. They were singing in every brother's song, Walk Right Back. And he was just like, why are we not cutting that? Let's cut it right now. Boom. Let's go. Boom. So we did. And he also said, I said, do you want me to just like play rhythm and do the solo? He said, no, do, you know, play whatever you want to play.
Yeah.
Get the energy live. If it's not good, we fix it.
Yeah.
Through working with so many different companies over my lifetime, I have friends in every company. And one of my friends named Chris Middaugh had worked with Schertler before and now was working with Guild. And this was about, I don't know, a number of years ago. And I said, Chris, if you're working with Guild now, what would you think about maybe reissuing, making a Chris Hillman model Birds bass?
Yeah.
Because the bass that Chris played with the Birds on 8 Miles High and Turn, Turn, Turn and all that early stuff was a Guild.
Yeah.
And it was a single pickup Guild with a pickup in the bridge position, which is really unusual for a single pickup bass.
Right.
And flat wound strings, and Chris would roll the tone knob all the way off, play hard with a pick through a dual Showman. That's the sound. And so he said, yeah, let's do that. So we ended up, you know, trying to find pictures, color pictures of that bass, look at the sunburst and all this kind of things. And we got, you know, as close as we could, and it's a very nice bass. And I can't remember if I have number one and Chris has number two, or if it's the other way around. Somehow we have the first two prototypes. And he, you know, as a gift, he got one and gave it to Tom. And, you know, Tom was like a kid because he didn't know that it even, and in the 12th fret, the Birds logo is inlaid in there. And it's super cool. But just, you know, to see him be that excited, and he's got a lot of guitars.
Yes, he
like
does.
Like every, you know, the walls are surrounded with double levels of, you know, here's the Fender section, here's the Rickenbacker section, here's the Gibson section, here's the Vox section, you know, everything. Yeah. So to get him tickled by an instrument was pretty cool.
Presentation by True Tone, TrueTone.com.